The Free Library of Philadelphia is proud to present a podcast from our award-winning author events series, recorded live at the Parkway Central Library on the Benjamin Franklin Parkway. To learn more about the Free Library, our unique and inspiring collections, and how your contribution can help our programs and services for the community, please visit freelibrary.org.
Welcome to the Free Library of Philadelphia and to the Carol Phillips Endowed Lecture. My name is Andy Greenberg, and I'm a member of the Free Library Foundation's Board of Directors. This is the 11th edition of a lecture endowed by my family in memory of my mother, who happened to be an economist, as was my stepfather, Almerin Phillips. So tonight's lecture and lecturer are particularly dear to our hearts. This evening's author event is made possible by the Free Library of Philadelphia Foundation. Through the support of private philanthropy, the Free Library Foundation enriches the library's essential services and quality programs. It's a cell phone that needs to go off. I encourage everyone here to support the library to enable programs like this to continue. To learn more about the foundation, please visit freelibrary.org. Now, tonight I'm pleased to introduce Sylvia Nasser, economist, best-selling author, and the John S. and James L. Knight Professor of Business Journalism at Columbia University. Sylvia Nasser is the recipient of a National Book Critics Circle Award for her biography, A Beautiful Mind, about the schizophrenic, Nobel Prize-winning mathematician John Nash. Along with the international accolades the book received, it inspired the Academy Award-winning film of the same name, directed by Ron Howard and starring Russell Crowe. Tonight, Nasser will focus on her new book, Grand Pursuit, The Story of Economic Genius. It details the lives of 19th and 20th century economists like Friedrich Engels and John Maynard Keynes, and brings to light how these famous men and women used their economic insights to improve mankind and advance its material circumstances. Fortune magazine praised Grand Pursuit and Nasser, declaring, "Her canvas is epic. The details are fresh, at times startling. At the same time, gnarly but critical concepts shine through in all their richness and complexity. If only Econ 101 had been this interesting." My stepfather would agree with that, by the way. Here to interview Nasser tonight is Craig Eye, editor of the Philadelphia Business Journal. Eye has more than 20 years' experience in journalism, previously serving as editor of both the Birmingham and Baltimore Business Journals. It's a delight to have Sylvia Nasser here with us this evening. Ladies and gentlemen, please join me in welcoming Sylvia Nasser and Craig Eye.
Thank you.
Well, thank you very much. It's a real pleasure to be here tonight at the library. It's a beautiful library, and it's a real pleasure to be here with Sylvia Nasser.
And I want to thank you for having me here in this beautiful library, in this beautiful square. I spent a lot of time in libraries working on this book, and so I really appreciate this. Thank you.
So, Sylvia, I have to say, you know, I really admire your timing here with this book. And this book is
deliberate.
Sure it was. But it was, it's really, you know, and this is a time, we're really nationally and internationally, we're talking about economic policy, economic ideas. And I just basically wanted to get from you an idea of why you attempted to write a book like this and why you took on this kind of project.
Well, I had just finished A Beautiful Mind, and looking for a new story, and looking for a romantic and glamorous and exciting story. And the only, you know, you always look where, you know, in the area that you know. So I looked in economics. And at some point, when I discovered that the grand pursuit of economic thinkers has been for the last 150 years or so to overcome scarcity and to let humanity take its own fate into its hands for the first time, I thought, wow, this is like Jason and the Argonauts. This is like The Wizard of Oz. This is like Apollo 13. This is a really romantic story.
It really is.
So.
Yeah.
What I didn't know, of course, since I think my contract was a 3-year contract when I signed it, what I didn't know is how brilliant my timing would be, because, as I'm sure you know, nobody wants to read about economics when everything is just burbling along.
Right.
Right. So I just feel very, very clever to have picked this moment.
There are so many really interesting and fascinating characters in the book. You know, that's one thing, you know, in reading a lot of the dry textbooks that I read over the years in economics class, you know, I didn't realize, you know, the amazing stories here. You know, and I just wanted to ask you, like, what are some of your favorite characters that came out of here? I mean, you know, we talked a little bit backstage about Marx and his home life and things like that, but what are some of your characters?
Well, I think that, you know, I mean, people don't, none of these people started out, you know, when they were 14 and said, oh, my God, I want to be an economist. Okay. They started out to do all kinds of things, to become physicists, mathematicians, missionaries. John Maynard Keynes, who is the pivot, you know, one of the pivotal characters in the book, because his life sort of starts and ends with, you know, it spans the biggest crises, the biggest challenges in the 20th century. And that's generally what happened. The people who started out to do other things, to become novelists or physicists, were pulled in because something was happening in their city, in their country, in the world, that brought economic questions to that they saw as an economic question, and they turned to economics because it seemed to offer a handle for doing something about it. Okay, so it's, you know, I chose my characters by the time, you know, the moment that they were drawn to economics and by the events that motivated them to come up with a solution, okay, or a big insight that proved to be vital for the kind of society that, you know, that lifted people up and that overcame difficulties.
You mentioned Keynes. Keynes certainly right now is a subject of great controversy. Because you brought him up, I was just interested in what you think of the current controversy over Keynes.
Well, he's amazingly present for somebody who's been dead for 55 years, and I noticed that he has more Google hits than Leonardo DiCaprio, and I suppose that's why Rick Perry felt that he needed to remind everyone that Keynes is in fact deceased. I'm not that interested in whether Keynes is the devil incarnate or saint. I'm more interested in what he did when the world faced its greatest crises. Okay, so the first, you know, what happened starting around the 1870s is for the first time average living standards, the average wage, which had been stuck at subsistence for 2,000 years, started going up. In other words, ordinary people started having a chance at having a life. And that was that great gold, you know, burst of growth, the first ever, came to an end at World War II. So the first big, you know, huge world crisis was the aftermath of World War II. And there is Keynes, who was a, you know, brilliant young mathematician to be, and then, you know, civil servant, is in Paris at the Paris Peace Talks, and Europe is impoverished and starving. The economic mechanism is completely jammed. Nothing's happened. You know, people can't produce. They can't sell. They can't, you know, return to normal economic life. And none of the leaders of the you know, allied leaders of the Western world would pay attention to that, okay? And Keynes tries to get their attention, but he's too junior, okay? And we have a peace treaty that does not is not focused on, doesn't even permit economic recovery, you know, the restoration of trade, the stabilization of currencies, the settling of these terrible war debts that everybody was saddled with. And, you know, Keynes fails to influence the outcome, okay? So he goes back home and writes a book. But then, fast forward another 20 years, and it's the end of another war, okay? Also a world war that has impoverished and disrupted the, you know, people's making a living. And this time, Keynes is, he's, you know, the sort of de facto Treasury Secretary. He's in a position of great influence. He's near the people in power. He can help determine the outcome. And what's the result? That now, you know, now the leaders of the world, FDR and Churchill, understand that economic recovery is key to you know, democracy and free markets, and that it can't happen. It's not going to happen automatically. The countries of the world have to get together and cooperate, and that's Bretton Woods. Bretton Woods was, which is where the IMF was born, the World Bank. That was an effort to do better than last time, and Keynes had the rare, you know, he had a second take, just like in the movies. He got to do something that he couldn't achieve the first time around. He got to take another crack at it, and you know, the difference in the 50s and 60s versus the 20s and 30s in Europe should be evident.
Right. Yeah. So the book is divided into really three acts. It's hope, fear, and confidence. And I was wondering if you could kind of take us through that and kind of you know, see how it evolved.
Right. Well, you know, if you look at, I said, you know, a minute ago that what marks our, you know, era, okay, modernity off from everything else that went before, okay, everything before, say, Jane Austen, is that for 2,000 years, the average human being lived at subsistence, which means in a state of destitution, and that never changed. Okay, great civilizations, Rome, medieval China, the great inventions, the great art, nothing affected the way ordinary people lived and the drudgery that ordinary people's lives were consumed by, okay? And what happened was that starting around 1848, the year of the Communist Manifesto, the living standards, took off, okay? Real wages started rising. People, year in and year out, there was a, small improvement that added up to a tenfold increase in the standard of living. What did that mean? It meant that, now people live 2.5 times, they have 2.5 lifetimes compared to the average person in 1800. And what they have, the means at their disposal to fulfill their own, goals and objectives has been increased 10 times, right? So that's what happened in that period, okay? So that was, the way I think of it is that was the first golden age, okay? That was, globalization, the fruits of the Industrial Revolution, but things were changing. And what did that do? There are people who, in the 1840s, Dickens being one of them, who could imagine that what seemed to be fixed and frozen, okay, designed by nature, designed by God, everyone in their place, people, could start imagining that that could change, okay? So actually, my first character is because this was an act of imagination, was Dickens. What ended that period was World War I, which, disrupted the rise in living standards, the, economic growth, and discredited the achievements of that age. And what followed was a period of tremendous economic and political chaos. The book moves from London, from Victorian London, where all these hopeful ideas are bubbling up and people come to London to see it happening and to debate and to watch it. You move to Vienna in 1919. Keynes, of course, is in Paris with the Allies, but Vienna, which is one of the great capitals of Europe, is dark, freezing, and starving. Okay, people, people are desperate. Returning soldiers. There's violence. People, a police horse is shot in the street. People carve it up and, take hunks of...
That was a disturbing story, yeah.
Yeah, I mean, and this was the last, the last days of mankind. The feeling was, the world as we knew it is reverting to barbarism, okay? So that, that whole period of, you know, hyperinflation, the Great Depression, and a Second World War in a 20-year span is, call that fear, because the fear was that what had, you know, what had happened before World War I was a dream, and that this nightmare would always go on, okay, and that we would couldn't do anything about it, or had to resort to extreme alternatives. And that's not what happened, of course. What happened is, you know, Keynes's second chance and a world after World War II that looked a lot like the world before World War I. You know, increasing prosperity, less and less poverty, and more and more. And there were many crises, but a growing sense that we are, you know, can do something. We're not at the mercy.
And Sylvia, out of that confidence really came this this kind of broad economic consensus. We talked about Bretton Woods and those kinds of things. But what do you see right now? What is the state of that sort of consensus that existed after World War II? And what do you see, you know, as kind of the major areas of agreement and disagreement among economists right now? And, you know, how that plays into that confidence level that we saw in the post-war years?
Well, I think that I think that we have the impression that you know that everything is controversial, but I don't think that in my book you're constantly seeing people who are typically thought of as antipodes who are in fact finding common ground. Okay, and for example, Hayek, Friedrich Hayek, who it was an Austrian who was a corporal in World War I, who witnessed the whole degeneration of Austrian democracy after all the way to the Anschluss in the 1930s, and who believed that any effort by the state, by the government, to intervene, would always do more harm than good, and who became the sort of anti-Keynes. That's how Hayek actually defined himself, which is actually not atypical in economics, that young hotshots who want to, make a mark, define themselves by sort of attacking the reigning deity, which in this case was Keynes. And so when Keynes, in the 20s, when Keynes was very much at the forefront of the notion that not only have we, solved this long-term problem of, raising living standards by, increasing productivity, but we can probably also smooth out these violent gyrations in economic activity. And by the way, I thought it was really amazing this morning on Squawk Box, somebody, there were four guys, and of course they talked much more than I did. It was hard to get a word in edgewise, but the first claim was that, well, economists have never studied money, and they don't understand, they've never really thought about the relationship between money and, the real economy, i.e. jobs and production, etc. Oh, my God, wait a minute. There have been you know, financial crises that have, of course, preoccupied the economics, you know, people who were interested in economics and drew them to economics, this whole period, okay? And especially, you know, in the United States, where the only, you know, the two topics were, you know, should we be on the, you know, gold standard or the silver standard? This was in the, you know, progressive era. And should we have free trade or protection, right? That was, anyway, I lost my thread.
Yeah. Well, along those same lines, you know, I was reading a review of your book in the Wall Street Journal, and James Grant had sort of taken issue with the fact that economists have had much effect at all. You know, as what he said was, and he wrote, economists no more set the world to producing and consuming than analysts of baseball stats hit home runs. And I was wondering if you had a response to that.
I think that's an amazing, I think that is just such an amazing proposition. Because when I think about, you know, like the sort of great technological breakthroughs of, say, the 1930s, which were an incredibly dynamic and innovative era. I think of the GW Bridge, the Lincoln Tunnel, the Empire State Building, the Hoover Dam. Okay? And is there anybody in this room or in any room that would say that, you know, science had nothing to do with those, or the understanding of physics and engineering and had nothing to do with? I don't think so. I mean, you know, please contradict me. So the idea that the economic success of, let's just take England, okay, that the incredible economic success of England in the last 150 years, even though England's not the most successful, but, okay, that the idea that that has nothing to do with people's understanding of what would foster growth and equity is astonishing to me, because isn't it, I mean, just think about the successful economies and then the economies that fail terribly, and think about, well, did that have anything to do with ideas? I mean, there were lots of economies that didn't take advantage of the development of this engine of analysis that helped people understand how the economy worked and what worked and what didn't. Okay, can you think of countries that absolutely rejected that? I can't. You know, half of the population of the world lived in them. Okay. And so I would say that the empirical evidence is that what you believe, has a tremendous amount to do with whether you can, you know, build a tunnel that won't collapse, or whether you can foster an economic environment which is, conducive to economic growth. So that would be my...
Sure.
I just want to, you know, add something else, which is, again, you know, that if you look at, you know, you look at the, you know, history from the Roman Empire through the medieval China, and through the Renaissance, you know, with this incredible, accumulation of knowledge and invention, Okay, I think the Chinese did really invent everything in the 15th century, but none, you know, until the, you know, the second half of the 19th century, none of that knowledge, none of those inventions ever affected the way that nine out of 10, if not more, of us lived, okay? So, my feeling is that it wasn't just technology. It wasn't just invention. It wasn't the steam engine. It was what, you know, it was the circumstances that were fertile, okay?
Right.
And those, and knowing, you know, I'm a gardener, okay? And you don't need that much science, but it is based on science. And knowing, you know, what makes good soil and what you have to do does make a big difference in how things turn out.
So building on that, what message do you hope that people take away from Grand Pursuit when they read it? What do you want them to walk away and think about?
Well, first of all, you know, I think that if you read, you know, if you read this story as it unfolds, you'll come away feeling a lot better about not complacent, you're not going to say, oh boy, this is, you know, things are really, you know, as good as they can be, but you're going to feel a lot better because we've come a tremendously long way in a very short period of time, 150 years, and in the course of that, and not because it was smooth sailing, in the course of that, have overcome, you know, tremendous, tremendous challenges that are at least as great and, in fact, far greater than the one we're facing now. And we, you know, with the help of knowledge that, you know, these people contributed, we overcame them. And I think that's really an important thing to know when you're facing a difficult challenge, that, you know, that you can, you know, face it with confidence. So that's one thing. And, you know, then there are, you know, the specific insights that that these individuals had, you know, like Alfred Marshall, who is you know, was always portrayed as this Victorian fuddy-duddy, who, and you know, in contrast to the daring and, you know, big picture Marx, but it's really Marshall, who was Keynes's teacher, who first of all transforms economics from a set of, really an ideology almost, a set of you know, laws that basically said, well, the nation could get richer, but the bottom 90% had no prayer of improvement. Into a, you know, not a set of conclusions, but an apparatus of the mind, a way of a science, a way to break big complex problems down into smaller and more tractable ones, and methods for dealing with them, which is what every science is. I mean, it's not, you know, it's not more complicated than that, but that's what they did, okay? They and that's why, you know, Milton Friedman and Paul Samuelson, who, you know, are often considered the antipodes of the, you know, post-war economics, have much more in common with each other and much more common ground than either of them have with a lot of other people. Okay. Yeah.
Okay. I think at this point we'll open it up to questions in the audience. So if anybody has a question, we'll find you with a microphone. So, okay. Yeah. Right there.
Which current economists should the President and Congress be listening to, and what are their messages?
Well, look, I think that, you know, if you look at the way that, you know, Joseph Schumpeter behaved in, you know, in 1919 when his country was falling apart and he was the finance minister, or what Hayek did when he was on his book tour here and the Republicans wanted to kill Bretton Woods, and, you know, and he, of course, was, you know, their darling because he was seemed to be conservative, that he plugged for Bretton Woods. I think that, you know, the kind of economist who will, not be uncompromising, but, you know, offer solutions. And, you know, this is what, you know, Irving Fisher and Keynes did in the Great Depression when they didn't stop. You know, they had their, they had their proposals. They wanted to fight the Depression with, very aggressive monetary policy, which meant getting rid of the gold standard. When that, you know, when there was no hope of the Hoover administration embracing that, they came up with other ideas. Okay, they never gave up. They never, when the Depression got worse instead of getting better, they went back to the drawing board and examined their own ideas. And that, you know, and they worked with people who, with whom they had many disagreements. And that, to me, is there are lots of great economists now, and I think that, you know, and I don't think their political persuasion matters. I think it's their willingness to look at and propose positive steps to, help resolve these challenges.
Anyone else? Yes.
A lot of what you've been focusing on is Western thought. How does that play into what's happening in China today?
Well, the book, the last character in the book is Amartya Sen. And I don't know if you know him. He is from India. And he's a philosopher as well as an economic thinker. And he's in the last chapter because not only did this idea that you could change people's circumstances and we could learn to take fate in our own hands and we could learn to use that positively, it was an idea that grew, not just in time but geographically, okay, and it started in London, and it spread from there, and then it was, you know, the West, and then it was Japan and. And now, and this is, you know, this is, it's so amazing that the two most populous countries, and if we talk about poverty, the fact that the two most populous countries in the world, who represent 40% of the world's people, have gone from, dysfunction and, stagnation, and almost overnight, okay, sort of are repeating the trajectory of 19th century England. And it's really amazing. It's really amazing. And China, China's still a poor country, okay? its per capita income is about what the U.S. had in the around 1930, when a big chunk of the American population was still on the farm and desperately poor, which was, you know, where most of the, you know, extreme suffering in the Depression took place. But I had students. I teach business journalism, so economic journalism for economics for journalists. And one of the early assignments in the course is to write a piece on in what generation did your family emerge from poverty, okay? And it's a students love the assignment. I love reading their stories. And Carolyn Swee, who's now at the Wall Street Journal, wrote about, she's from Beijing, and her English was very poor at the beginning of the semester. She wrote about her family, and, you know, in one generation, her family went from leapt to a modern standard of living, okay? In other words, her grandparents were peasants on a communal farm who had, they were lucky that they didn't die in the great famine after the Great Leap. They had nothing. They had no material support for their lives, but none of the autonomy that goes with a modern standard of living. And here was Caroline, in New York, getting ready to be a reporter at the Wall Street Journal. It's incredible.
Yeah.
I mean, look, my family immigrated, okay? And I think that one of the reasons that this story seems so, romantic to me is that, in coming to the United States from war-devastated Germany after World War II, and coming to the U.S. in 1951, and, I mean, I remember, my parents, who, of course, were very young then, being so excited when they went to the grocery store, or so appalled when, they saw people, in restaurants throwing out food. And just the idea that you could go from one circumstance to another like that, and realizing how significant it is for individual lives. Because, my father might have moved to Turkey. And I always think, well, what would have happened to me if instead of here, I grew up in Turkey, the Turkey of the 1950s and 60s. I doubt that we'd be here talking.
Right. Good point. Yeah. Anyone else? Come in the back there. Blue shirt. I'm going to mix it up.
What about sustainable economics for going forward? Because the growth model might be at its end.
Well, I don't know if you've ever, 2 years ago, the first woman to win a Nobel Prize, her name is Eleanor Ostrom. And a lot of the really exciting things that are happening in economics right now are sort of at the border of other disciplines, in her case, political science. So she got a Nobel Prize because she works on issues of sustainable development, and particularly looking at the contrast between unsustainable paths, such as the ocean fisheries, and discovering that the onshore fisheries, okay, that many of them developed spontaneously, not as a result of business, not as a result of government intervention, but these communities developed rules and ways of operating that put them on a sustainable path, okay? It's a very sort of specific point, right, where... I think that she's certainly one of the most interesting I think she's one of the most interesting people in economics. And frankly, although a friend of mine, nominated her for the prize, I had never, I never knew about her until he described her work. She's at the, she's at the University of Indiana.
Anyone else?
Okay. Now that you've completed your book and had a chance to think about it, is there a character you left out or you would like to put in, and why?
Well, there were several. I mean, look, the big challenge of this book, the big challenge of A Beautiful Mind was obviously to find out what happened, the story of John Nash's life. It was a reporting challenge. The narrative was handed to me on a silver, all I had to do was see that, this was a life with a third act, it's a pretty iconic kind of fairy tale structure. But, figuring out what the narrative was here was the big challenge, okay? First of all, to learn a lot of history and a lot of biography and a lot of the evolution of these people's ideas, to even be able to think about, okay, what is the story? and that's why some people that I really would have loved to have included had to be ruthlessly excised. John von Neumann was one, and I actually spent a lot of time, I don't know if you know who he is, but he's one of these, he's like the Keynes of mathematics in the 20th century. He was, he invented game theory and several other branches of pure mathematics. He was integral to the development of the atomic and the hydrogen bomb in the Manhattan Project, and he was the one of the inventors of the modern computer, the programmable computer. So I very much wanted, I very much wanted to include him. And the other person that I might actually do a book about at some point is Frank Ramsey, who was whose ideas are very relevant to to environmental economics, and who had a very, very romantic life and died at the age of 26. But in his short but very, very brilliant career, he he basically, founded several different, every paper he wrote led to a whole, a whole field, both in mathematics, in philosophy, and amazingly in economics, because he was one of the beautiful young men that Keynes, who was, bisexual, took under his wing.
Anyone else?
I was wondering if your book at all deals with the extreme energy, like how extreme we're getting about energy extraction, or sort of the economics of the extreme energy extractions such as fracking, deep water drilling, mountaintop removal, that type of?
Actually, no. No. I mean, there is an energy crisis that, you know, that plays a role in the book, and that is, of course, the, you know, happened around 1860 and when England appeared to be running out of coal. And it would, that was really sort of integral to the whole notion of limits to growth, okay, which was a really kind of amazing that in the middle of what, you know, the most revolutionary change in sort of, you know, dynamics of, you know, technology and economics, you know, the received wisdom among very great people like John Stuart Mill was that, you know, England, the England of the 1848 was about, was pretty close to, you know, where you would want to end up, okay? He also said that economics was a pretty settled field, which...
Go ahead. Anyone else? Yes, sir.
Just to sort of come back to where you started with Keynes, if part of your thesis is that there has been this arc of progress in economic thought, and Keynes, you know, was central to the modern view, then how do you deal with the fact that he is still so controversial, and that there's such a strong debate about how to respond, for instance, to the current worldwide financial crisis? Is that, or is that sort of tangential to larger trends like the international architecture that's developed? I just wonder. But as an empirical point, people are really debating Keynesian economics still, and different countries are responding in different ways. So. What do you do with that?
Well, it is a, you know, a lot of the issues are the same issues that were debated in the 1930s, in the 1920s and 30s, okay? And, you know, there's so many ways this breaks down, but one way is between the people who say really the only economic problems that are truly significant are, you know, is this question of long-term, you know, growth, by which all we mean is you know, the, you know, can the economy over time do more and more with the same resources, okay? All right, that's really what productivity growth means. It means doing more with what you have. Okay, and that was, you know, that was the position of you know, say Hayek. Okay, now, you know, he did recant by, you know, by the time he wrote to Serfdom, he agreed that democracy and free markets were not compatible, could not survive, extreme inflation and extreme unemployment. Okay? So, so someone like Keynes, who we think of as only focusing on the short-run problem, which is the problem of, you know, of deflations and depressions and unemployment, or, you know, inflationary booms. You know, that's kind of a mischaracterization. That was the problem that he focused on, but. You know, in 1931, when that problem was going from, you know, when the Depression was becoming great, in other words, was morphing from a, you know, just a nasty recession into something, you know, that was feeding on itself, he took, you know, that opportunity to say, look, you know, and lots of intellectuals were saying, okay, this is the end of the West. It doesn't work. Okay, we better, you know, look elsewhere. Keynes took the opportunity to say, look, we have, you know, we have a short-term problem. It's a mechanical problem. It's, you know, and he compared it, you know, for somebody who never learned how to drive and complained about, you know, using the telephone, he used a lot of automotive analogies. And he, you know, he said, what we have, you know, this terrible crisis that people are saying, you know, it's the punishment for, you know, our excesses and the booms, and it's this and that, or it's inequality, or, you know, is really a starter problem. It's a technical problem, okay? And, you know, specifically what he meant was that it had to do with the management of the money supply, and that the, you know, people in charge, you know, because of their fetish of the gold standard, et cetera, had allowed the, you know, the money supply to shrink by a third. The result was falling prices, and, you know, anyone here who runs a business can, you know, would know instantly that, you know, what happens in, when prices are falling, you can't, you know, when you can't cover your costs, so you have to cut back more, and, you know, downward spiral. But the point is that once you got to the point, you know, once you agreed, and, you know, Schumpeter, you know, when he was finance minister in Austria, you know, certainly once you realize you can't survive politically if people are, you know, out of work and or are being robbed by inflation, then it's a problem that is worth addressing, or that you have to address. Okay. Now, of course, if you don't have a clue what to do, and or there's no handle for, you know, the government to intervene, then it's kind of moot. But, you know, what Irving Fisher and Keynes figured out in the 20s was that this, you know, these wild gyrations in the economy mainly came from the same source, and that was, you know, the failure to manage, the mismanagement of the one thing that governments then, which of course were much smaller, controlled, which was the issuance of money. So,
so Sylvia, I have one last question for you. Okay, A Beautiful Mind, a great movie. Is there a possibility of a movie out of Grand Pursuit? Could Russell Crowe play Keynes or something?
Well, let's see. You know, I'm really sorry that I didn't think there's a trailer. Okay, there is a trailer. It's called Economic Progress: The History of Economic Progress in 4 Minutes.
I saw that. It's great. Yeah.
Okay, it's an animated cartoon. Okay, so I emailed it. I emailed the link to Ron Howard and said, Ron, this is the movie version, and I'm sending you the book. So he misunderstood. He said, wrote back, you know, a little mystified. He said, you know, I don't know if I see the movie here, but I really like the I really like the cartoon. So,
Sylvia Nasser, thank you very much.
Thank you.
Thank you for listening to this podcast from the Free Library of Great Conversations. If you live in Philadelphia or are planning a visit and would like to attend an author event, information on the series is available at freelibrary.org/authorevents.